Snow, sacks, and second chances. Snow, sacks, and second chances. Our family was growing, and so were our ambitions. In 1987, Sally and I welcomed our first son, Ben. Joy, fear, exhaustion, they all crashed over us in one unstoppable wave. We were everything new parents are supposed to be, elated, terrified, and completely out of our depth. Soon after, we planted our second real stake in the ground, a modest two-bedroom flat in Broccoli. It wasn't grand, but to us, it was everything. A sanctuary that whispered, "This is where it begins." A promise that we were building something real. By 1988, still high on optimism, we took another leap and opened a second deli in Greenwich. Brave? Maybe? Risky? Absolutely. And at first, it flopped. The customers came, but the concept missed the mark. So we adapted. Ripped up the plan, turned it into a coffee bar, and that changed everything. Suddenly, the place buzzed like a street carnival. Clinking cups, bursts of laughter, conversations weaving through the air like music. Our own little kingdom in the heart of Greenwich. Then life cranked up the volume. Our second son, Remy, arrived in July, a glorious storm of chaos and beauty. Two boys now, a business finding its rhythm, our world ballooning in every direction. We traded up for a four-bedroom house in Lewisham, and to us it felt like a palace. Sally wasn't ready to hang up her apron just yet, so we brought in au pairs to help with the boys. Our Greenwich landlord, Gary, was a character straight out of a travel magazine. He ran a ski shop, organized chalet trips to Austria, and always seemed to have one foot in the Alps. At the beginning of December 1991, he dangled an offer too tempting to resist, a discounted skiing holiday in Innsbruck over Christmas. We hardly needed persuading. Of course we said yes. Christmas Day was ours. Family, laughter, and a tree groaning under the weight of tinsel. But by Boxing Day morning we were at Gatwick, bags packed, the boys in tow, fizzing with the excitement of a holiday we hadn't seen coming just weeks before. The airport thrummed with energy, alive with familiar faces, friends, fellow shopkeepers, all swept up in the shared anticipation of a week in the Alps. The next morning, Sally hit the slopes like a woman on a mission. Booked in, zipped up, goggles down, pure determination wrapped in neon ski gear. If anyone was going to conquer those mountains with style, it was her. Me? I swaggered in with misplaced confidence. How hard could it be? We had childcare lined up, after all. Or so we thought. Reality hit fast. The babysitter was hopeless. The boys were inconsolable, crying, clinging to us like shipwreck survivors. The chalet filled with high-pitched wails and little hands tugging at ski suits, their tiny faces streaked with tears. Dreams of black runs and après-ski evaporated under the relentless pull of parenthood. So I did what any decent dad would do. I hung up my skis and stayed behind. My slopes were nappies. My après-ski was bedtime stories. Not the alpine fantasy I'd pictured, but the right call. Then, like a snow angel descending from heaven, salvation arrived. A new sitter. Young, patient, and instantly adored by Ben and Remy. She swept them off tobogganing, their laughter echoing down the hills as I stood there clutching my newfound freedom. And that's when I made my big mistake. Instead of going back to ski school, I thought, sod it, I'll wing it. How hard could skiing really be? That night I practiced in front of the chalet mirror like some aging gladiator, legs bent in my so-called gorilla stance, muttering under my breath, "Snowplow, snowplow," as if repeating the word could keep me alive. Morning came, pride puffed up my chest as I strutted to the ski lift solo. The air was sharp enough to bite, the mountains rising like frozen cathedrals against a cobalt sky. For a fleeting moment, I felt invincible. Then came the lift, a rickety, swaying contraption of steel and spite. I hooked the narrow bar between my legs, clinging on as it jerked to life and began dragging me up the slope. Higher and higher it climbed, the mountain stretching out like a frozen kingdom. And then it hit me, cold and brutal as an avalanche. I had no bloody idea how to get off, not a clue. Panic clawed at my chest, my heart hammered in time with the creak of the lift, and then, without warning, it spat me out. One brutal jolt and I was airborne, dumped like a sack of potatoes into a blinding sea of snow. I scrambled up, pointed myself downhill, and pushed off. At first, it was glorious. I zigzagged, I leaned, I carved through the powder like a man born to ski. Pride swelled. "Look at me now, Sally." But mountains don't care about pride. Speed came like a thief in the night, silent, then savage. Balance gone, control gone. Suddenly I was hurtling, knees buckling, poles flailing, a blur of limbs and blind panic. I shot past Sally's ski group, her jaw practically hit the snow as I tore past like a runaway train. And then I saw it, a road, an actual road, slicing across the bottom of the slope like a death sentence. No fences, no nets, just black tarmac waiting to turn me into a human snowball. I had seconds to act. I aimed for a set of poles strung with ropes, something, anything to stop me. The ropes caught me mid-chest like a lasso. The impact ripped the air from my lungs and sent me flying. I landed flat on my back, staring at the sky, my heart jackhammering in my chest. The poles snapped like matchsticks. Later, a mate who'd seen everything, except the spectacular crash, swore I looked like a pro. Smooth, fearless, unstoppable, he said. I laughed, trying to mask the throbbing in my ribs. You've either got it or you haven't. But flat on my back in the snow, bruised but breathing, I wasn't so sure which camp I belonged to. Still, I'd live to tell the tale. And sometimes survival is victory enough. It had been years, no decades, since Swanley. Since the chaos and carnage of childhood, conquer wars that left knuckles raw, playground brawls over nothing, and snot-nosed legends passed from one term to the next. All of it packed away, like dusty exercise books shoved into a forgotten attic. Life had moved on. I was running a bustling cafe in Greenwich with Sally, just steps from the weekend market, where the smell of melting brie and caramel pastries spilled out into the street like an invitation. Saturdays were a beautiful kind of madness. Coffee machines steaming, orders flying, the constant clatter and hum of a place alive. Across the cobbled street, nestled between a shop selling overpriced vegan soap and a stall spinning rare vinyl, was a small art gallery run by none other than Mark Collins, an old face from school. A quiet, watchful lad turned soft-spoken artist, always smudged with clay or streaked with paint. He'd stumbled into our cafe one day, spotted me behind the counter, and from then on became part of the furniture. Lunchtime chats, dry wit, the kind of easy company that only comes from knowing someone since the age of grazed knees and detention slips. Then came that Saturday. The sun was blazing off the Thames, customers packed in, till queue snaking toward the door, and the place buzzing like a live wire. Mark was halfway through a story, leaning on the counter, when he suddenly froze, his whole body taut like a piano string. He squinted toward the tables, his voice dropping to a whisper. Oi, is that Johnny Yielding? And just like that, the name hit me like a punch in the gut. I turned. There, by the window framed in sunlight, was a man about our age, broader now, softer around the eyes, but those eyes, restless, gleaming, always half looking for trouble. And beside him, like a queen in exile, sat his mum. Regal posture, eyes like steel. I wasn't in Greenwich anymore. I was 15 years old again, watching Johnny and the Rye boys tear across concrete playgrounds and corridors like unleashed wolves. Chaos was their language, mayhem their music. It is him, I muttered. Mark ducked behind the fridge like a school kid avoiding eye contact with a supply teacher. Jesus Christ, he hissed. Tell me when it's safe. I laughed. That fear was still there, embedded like shrapnel. The legend of Johnny Yielding lingered, long after the fight stopped, but I couldn't let it slide. Fate doesn't drop ghosts in your lap for no reason. I wove through the tables, through steam and chatter, till I stood right in front of him. He looked up. We locked eyes. No fear now, just a strange warmth of recognition. You're Johnny Yielding, aren't you? Before he could speak, his mum beat him to it, voice cutting through the cafe like a dagger. Fuck me. He ain't barred from here too, is he? That did it. I howled. So did Johnny. All the years, all the stories, all the scrapes and scars and whispered rumors, we didn't need to say a word. It was all there, crackling in the laughter. We sat and talked for 15 minutes, maybe more. The kind of talk that stitches together the past and the present, the fights, the mischief, the madness. He grinned and shook his head. We were fucking mad back then, weren't we? Mad didn't cover it. But now? Just two older blokes with tea and no blood left in the battles, just stories. And then there was Alan. Back in those days, milk was delivered by legends. Ours came from Dudgy, a third-generation milkman out of a tiny shop in Royal Hill. 7 days a week, come rain, hail, or a heat wave that could fry an egg on the bonnet, Dougie did the rounds. He wasn't just reliable, he was legendary. He reminds me of Ernie, the fastest milkman in the West, Except Dougie wasn't rattling glass bottles. He was tearing through Greenwich with the sort of speed that made pigeons scatter and traffic wardens weep. His van wasn't the sleek steed of a cowboy, but it moved like one, coughing, spluttering, and somehow flying all the same. And then one day, he passed, and just like that, the line ended. No encore, no curtain call. The fastest man in the West had run his final route. His kids didn't want milk. They wanted spreadsheets and skyline views in Canary Wharf. His route was snapped up by Express, a slick operation who franchised it out. Alan got the Greenwich Square. He was all cheek, grin always loaded, sexual innuendo forever dangling on his tongue. He hit it off immediately with the staff, especially Angie and Debbie. A Millwall season ticket holder. I was West Ham through and through. We shouldn't have clicked, but we did, like petrol and fire. He found out I played squash. Said he did too. I had a membership at the Naval College across the road. So we started playing ad hoc matches, middle of the day, best of five. When I won, which was often, I'd scribble the scores in chalk on the A-board outside. Alan, mate, you played well, but I played better. He'd curse and laugh, plotting revenge over cappuccinos. We've stayed mates ever since. Cafe life in Greenwich was its own little symphony. Steaming milk, sizzling pans, jazz humming low in the background. Blackheath called to me like a second wind, a whisper I couldn't ignore. I found the spot, a tired old ex-charity shop that stank of mildew and forgotten dreams. Most people would have crossed the street and kept walking. But me, I saw what it could become. Fred and Martin saw it too. We rolled up our sleeves and tore the place apart, ripped it back to its bones. Brick by brick, we rebuilt it. Upstairs became Pistachio's Cafe, bright, buzzing, the heartbeat of the high street. But downstairs, that was for something different. Something with danger and smoke curling at the edges, a jazz bar, lit low, whispering secrets and possibility. The kind of place where the night didn't just pass, it lived. I wanted something bold to stamp its identity, something that screamed art and jazz in the same breath. That's when Jaunty stepped in, a Geordie artist and performer, a friend Crofty had introduced me to, a rare talent. His sonnets and lyrics could stop you mid-sentence. His artistic energy flowed like liquid fire. I've got it, he said one night, eyes flashing. You want jazz? You want soul? You need Matisse. And so he gave us the Blue Nude. Sensual curves painted straight onto the downstairs bar, the color burning electric against the wood. It was iconic, magnetic. We put it on the menu covers, too. Jaunty didn't just give us a logo, he gave us a pulse. Back in Greenwich, Angie held the fort like a general, flanked by her sister Debbie and their mum Kathy. That freed me to pour everything into Blackheath, and then, boom, it exploded. Word spread like wildfire. Glenn Tilbrook of Squeeze, whose studio was just behind us, became a regular. Sometimes unannounced, he'd slip into the basement, guitar in hand, and play an impromptu set. The air would tighten, crackle. You could feel the walls leaning in, hungry for every note. Our late-night lock-ins became legend. Off-duty coppers from Lewisham stormed the place like a private club, pints in hand, roaring karaoke classics at 2 a.m. One night, a copper leaned in close, beer sloshing down his wrist, and whispered like a man sharing state secrets. Mate, want to get round licensing? Sell it now. Ring it through tomorrow's till. Then the wink. Simple. And simple it was. And it worked. The place didn't just buzz. It roared. Like a live wire sparking in the dark. Paul the Irishman ran the bar, always with a joke and a knowing look. Marion, Crofty's ex, sang when the mood took her, and when she did, the whole place stilled. Eileen and Donna ran the cafe like it was their own kitchen, laughing with regulars, remembering orders before they were placed. It wasn't just a cafe. It was my sanctuary. A heartbeat in bricks and steam. A home born from a flicker of a dream I once dared to believe in, and somehow made real. For a fleeting golden moment, it felt like the world had bent in my favor. Like everything I laid my hands on sparked to life. The jazz bar, tucked beneath our cafe on Tranquil Vale, had witnessed its fair share of magic, nights soaked in melody, mischief, and memory. But nothing, absolutely nothing, came close to the 2 sold-out evenings when Bert Jansch, the legendary fingerstyle guitarist, stepped onto our postage stamp stage. He sat beneath the low amber lights, hunched slightly, guitar resting in his lap like an extension of his soul. Each note he played bled raw and intimate into the crumbling brick walls, the kind of music that bypassed the ears and went straight to the chest. The room was thick with cigarette smoke and the syrupy scent of cheap bourbon. No one spoke. People leaned forward in silence, eyes wide, reverent, as if gathered in a holy place. Every string he plucked hung in the air like a benediction. Then came the lock-in. After hours, the place softened, took on a shimmer. Glasses clinked gently, shadows stretched, laughter moved in low waves across the room. Bert packed away his guitar with the quiet satisfaction of a man who just bared his soul to a room that understood. I found myself leaning on the bar beside a stranger, some bloke I didn't recognize, both of us adrift in the afterglow. We got talking, aimless chat, harmless banter. He laughed, took a sip of whatever he was nursing, then leaned in, as if sharing a secret the walls shouldn't hear. "Funny thing," he said, smirking. "My mate Crofty used to work for this fella in Greenwich. One night, pissed out of his head, he nicked the bloke's delivery bike and flogged it for 50 quid. Bloke never even noticed." The words hit me like a brick to the ribs. I stared at him too long. The floor seemed to tilt, because I was that bloke. He didn't know, had no clue who he was talking to, just spinning some half-remembered pub tale. But in that moment, my mind began stitching together the truth, thread by thread. The bike. God, I remembered that bike. Black mountain frame, wicker baskets strapped front and back, with a custom pistachios tag zip-tied to the crossbar. We'd bought it in the early days for sandwich deliveries, back when I still believed I could do it all. Run the cafe, make the food, deliver orders down Royal Hill. But as business exploded, I was needed on the floor, behind the counter, everywhere except on two wheels. It gathered dust in the marquee out back, untouched but not unloved. Then one morning I opened up, and it was gone. No broken lock, no sign of struggle, just gone. I hadn't even been angry. If anything, relieved. We didn't need it anymore. It was insured. It freed up space. I shrugged, filed a report, claimed 350s, and moved on. Never gave it another thought. Crofty, of course, said nothing. But now, in this smoky bar, the memory snapped into place. That night, years ago, Crofty out on the lash, skint, no taxi, no way home, still half-cut and remembering he had the keys to the cafe, let himself in, spotted the bike, took it, rode off into the dark, wobbling down the street like some two-wheeled bandit. And when I'd mentioned it missing the next day, expecting shock and maybe a laugh, he just nodded. Deadpan. Didn't blink. If I was claiming the insurance, why muddy the water? But temptation had whispered, and Crofty had listened. Rather than return it, he'd sold it for a quick 50. And now here was his mate, years later, casually spilling the secret, completely unaware that the man he was telling it to was the victim of the crime. I didn't say a word. Not to him. Not to Crofty, who was probably somewhere else in the bar, beer in hand, holding court with tales of palace glory, or reminiscing about some long-forgotten Jivan instructor's gig in Bulgaria. Truth is, I didn't care about the bike, or the money. I valued Crofty far more than either. Fred was nearby. He'd heard it all. I saw his eyes flick to mine, recognition dawning, a flicker of disbelief turning into a knowing smirk. He got it. He understood. Why spoil the night? Especially this night. Bert Jansch had played in our jazz bar. That was the kind of thing you told your grandkids about. That was what mattered. Paul, our unflappable jazz club manager, was the one who'd booked him. Pulled it off with the quiet swagger of a man who never made a fuss. Paul had a gift. He could spot talent before it landed, reel it in without ego, like a fisherman who didn't need trophies. Blackheath was purring, running like a dream, which meant my eyes began to wander, looking for the next spark, the next wild idea. Butler's Wharf called to me first, glittering along the river like a promise, but Terence Conran had already laid claim to the best spots, locking down the waterfront with an iron grip. So I turned inward, toward Unit 18 in Shad Thames, where Pizza Express sits now. It ticked every box, location, footfall, layout, but William Stoffel, our solicitor, caught something hidden in the foundations, structural issues buried in the paperwork. He told me to walk away, and I did. Shad Thames faded, so my gaze turned further afield. Canterbury. There, just a stone's throw from the cathedral, stood a beautiful old Pierre Victoire restaurant, long vacant, aching for revival. Tourists, students, locals, it had the makings of something special. I could see it, hear it, taste it. The plan had formed. The dream was moving. And then, just as pen was poised over lease, everything stopped. News came. News that didn't just derail plans, it cracked the ground beneath my feet. News that would bring the Golden Run to a crashing, irreversible halt.